Cha-ching. That's the sound of Lowe's Labor Day savings. Get up to 45% off select major appliances and save up to an additional $100 on select laundry pairs. Plus, get 3 bags of Miracle-Gro 0.75 cubic foot garden soil for just $10. Labor Day deals are on now at Lowe's, in-store and online. Valid through 9/9 while supplies last. Selection varies by location. See Lowe's.com for more details. Soil offer excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
Welcome back to Evolution of a Snake. I'm Zach.
And I am Madeline.
And you are listening to a very special episode where I'm on the road. I'm in LA to shoot Protopop, and my equipment got lost in the mail, apparently. So we're working with a bit of a DIY setup today, but we could simply not skip a recap of something very important that happened. Madeline, what the hell are we talking about today?
So today we're talking about a very special interview slash performance that Taylor gave. I think it was at the Grammy Museum. Correct me if I'm wrong. I don't know where else they would have been. It was called Icon Sessions. And so what was the subtitle? Wasn't it like looking back at 20 years or something like mm-hmm. that?
Retrospective.
20-year retrospective. So color me surprised. This is the second kind of quote-unquote retrospective interview that she's given in the past year. She did the New York Times Best 30 Songwriters, American Songwriters, which was in a lot of ways retrospective, I think accidentally, just because they were talking about songwriting. This one was more deliberately, I am looking back on my career and my tenure as a songwriter.
This one felt to me a lot more satisfying because I think the questions were great. This is
really
the CEO
good.
Of the Recording Academy. He knows what he's talking about. He didn't interject too much. And also, Taylor was not repeating things that we've already heard. I found that the New York Times interview, there were amazing moments in it, but a lot of it was anecdotes that we've heard before. And that's really an us problem because we've been too clued in over the years. But this, I feel like I heard her say things that she hasn't said or that I've known her to believe but haven't heard her say in a while. And the context of which she was saying it was interesting, and I felt like there was no dead air in the interview. It was a very well-conducted interview, and everything that she said felt purposeful. There was no, for example, random aside about Brett.
Thank God, by the way. All of her, like, when she would drift, they were actually things that were still relevant to what we were talking about. There was one question he asked that I was like, I've always wanted to know that. There were several times where he asked a question where it was like, it was so inside and like so much of something that a genuine fan would ask that I was really gagged. In particular, one moment that comes to mind is when he asked Reputation and Lover, Light and Dark, Light versus Dark. Was that intentional or did it just happen that way? And I was like, and I've always wondered that exact same thing. And she answered the question. Now I finally know. He was kind of low-key giving CEO, not just the CEO, but the CEO.
Oh, he was giving CEO of the Grammys. And I think it's like Taylor has such a storied discography that you do have to be a student of it to ask her good and interesting questions. And it is interesting when we reflect on this year for her. I mean, technically this is Showgirl's album cycle and Showgirl year, but it has really turned into retrospective on my songwriting and my legacy as a songwriter. Naturally, it's 20 years since debut, so that is a relevant happening, hopefully on the horizon. But because of that, it seems that she's been in this very reflective state of mind with the Songwriters Hall of Fame. Everything has been oriented less around, I would really love to talk more about Showgirl, and more, I would really love to talk about my career and my experience as a songwriter. And I do think that people are getting so mad at the continued Showgirl critique, but unfortunately, girls, we're in the Showgirl era. It's relevant to the material, and it's an interesting conversation when we're talking about 20 years of Taylor Swift. It's interesting how infrequently it was mentioned, if at all, in this interview. All of her examples of songs and things to say were references from other moments in her discography. And I think the fact that it was not a major focus or even a consideration in a songwriting craft-oriented talk says something.
I do think, especially with the page 6, I don't want to say plant, but the page 6 headline that Taylor's working on new music, and them emphasizing she's really focusing on songwriting is really interesting to me. I find that if you wouldn't normally have to say that. Taylor's working on new music means that she is focusing on songwriting because that's what she does. The emphasis on she's focusing on songwriting in that specific page six, again, plant, is really interesting to me considering the era that we're in. I don't want to be too showgirl negative because I think everybody already knows what I think about it. But I do think I'm not sitting here thinking Taylor's going, wow, I made a huge massive mistake. But I do think she has taken note of the fact that one of the strongest and most repeated critiques of the record is that the songwriting was not very good. And I would imagine that would make her unhappy.
That is the kind of critique that burrows into her brain, as it should, because it gets at the core of what she does. And I think that in retrospect, she has now decided, I need to do a little bit of course correction. And the most damaging thing about Showgirl was the impact that it had on her perception as a songwriter. And Swifties will, you know, fight to the death about whether it did have a negative impact or not. But I think that the actions of the last year really show you that Taylor, whenever she does something, appears in public, like it's intentional and purposeful. This could have just been the year of I'm getting married and Showgirl, that's it. Instead, it is something very different to that. And I personally believe, yeah, from what we've said before, if you really want to hear the full deep dive, you have to buy the Showgirl Experience, our show where we really actually analyzed how this happened. It actually is a good resource. I think if you're confused about why we keep saying this, or if you don't understand why this is a course correction, patreon.com, go buy the show.
I like that you call it a resource. Because mm-hmm. It's kind of like, if you go into Patreon, it's sort of like a library in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. You can access these sort of texts, these foundational mm-hmm. texts of Evolution of Mistake and Taylor Swift. Everything is on there. Patreon.com/withologist.
And you can use them however you wish. You can use them to disagree, but they're texts, you know.
But at the end of the day, you can't deny that they are sacred tomes, many people mm-hmm. say. Thank you.
They are. What did we think of the look? I loved it, personally.
I liked it more in motion, which is funny because like it was a seated interview. But when she got up and she was moving to the piano and I saw how the fabric like moved, I was way more into it. I clocked the color. I noted it.
It's how can you look at this shade. And not say debut TV? How?
I clocked the beautiful shade of green. I really like the specific shade of green she's using to code debut. That kind of like muted sort of not quite pastel.
Yeah, not pastel, but almost, not like a really saturated like green.
Soft, soft green. I'm really enjoying that for debut because there's something kind of, this might sound weird, but it kind of reminds me of like if you were buying a baby blanket in the shade of green, it would be this color. And I just always think of debut as the baby and like kind of like the infant of the TSCU. So I think that's kind of cute.
It's kind of like girlish. Young. Yeah. It's sweet. It's innocent. Actually, it's very much like my Kindle cover that I have right here.
It's exactly like green. It's exactly like this.
It's Kindle's very that ready color. For debut TV. She is. I've been manifesting it for a minute now. But I think debut TV being on the horizon, we are running out of time for an announcement. I would like, can we have an announcement? I want an announcement. We're Easter egging it. This has got to be her longest Easter egg process of all time because it started really with debutation. I firmly believe that she was doing that. And that got completely thrown off course by, of course, we cheer getting the masters back. But at this point, I'm saying, Diva, please release the goddamn tapes or just tell me that they're coming. I need something to believe in.
I thought it was interesting, something that I've never thought about. I've always been really attached to October release just to honor the actual 20th anniversary. I never thought about her birthday. That never occurred to me.
I brought that up. I said birthday.
Birthday. And that, I'm completely amenable to that. A Christmas release, there's a little something to that. So I'm interested.
Well, 23rd October is kind of a nightmare date for both me and Madeline. So just so you guys know, if you're manifesting, don't manifest it to be on the 23rd of October if you would like us to have real-time reactions, because I will be on my 30th birthday extravaganza. Madeline will have been doing spooky birthday. We won't be around to really be boots on the ground. It'll have to wait. You'll have to wait. That's never happened before.
And you know what? There's something to that. In my mind, I'm like, maybe they should.
Yeah, maybe you guys should. You should have a Taylor release season without us around. See how much better it is.
See how you like it.
There are so many moving parts to being a full-time content creator, making thumbnails for videos, writing scripts for videos, writing the outline for episodes of the podcast, plus staying on top of what's going on in pop culture so we don't fall behind. With all of that going on, it can be pretty hard to find the time to make a doctor's appointment.
Enter the sponsor of today's video, ZocDoc. ZocDoc eliminates the most time-consuming parts of getting the care that you need by letting you search and compare local, in-network doctors right there online, so you don't have to spend too much time hunting all over the internet to find the best care for you. On the app, you can see actual appointment openings and click instantly to book a visit, so prioritizing your health feels so much easier.
And the absolute best part about ZocDoc is that it's free. Your health matters and taking care of yourself shouldn't feel overwhelming. Find and book the right doctor with ZocDoc.
Head to ZocDoc.com/snake to get started and check that appointment off your to-do list. That's ZocDoc.com/snake.
Well, Gorgina Gown, what did you think of the performance that she did?
Now, here's what I was, as I was watching it, I appreciated her describing for the first time ever. She never usually tells us why. She described exactly why she chose it. She was like, I thought these are all connected by memory, remembering something. And I was like, okay, that's great. But I'm asking why we did August and not Cardigan. I knew it. I knew you. I knew you. Da-da-da. Like, I don't, we kind of missed an opportunity there. I thought August didn't quite fit. It was kind of like, that was the one I thought was really horned in there, just like forced. It was kind of.
Especially with the key change.
I felt like I was at the Eras Tour going, thank you so much. But I would have preferred to have heard just one single song all the way through, my diva. Thank you as usual. But
that's the issue with the mashups. It's like, unless it's Out of the Woods, Is It Over Now? Or like something really seismic in that way that like really directly makes sense. It's always, I would just rather hear it. Also, we've heard All Too Well 89 million times. I'm good. I would have preferred just a really beautiful recording of I Knew It, I Knew You, because I thought that was the best part of it.
I loved hearing it on piano. Probably, I really like I Knew It, I Knew You, but if I had to say my least favorite part about it, the really ham-fisted, goofy Toy Story production. Yeah, it's a little much. So hearing it on the piano, I love it melodically. Like, the melody of the song is really beautiful, so I thought that was great. And then all of a sudden, it's salt air.
I was and like, no, damn, I need to be.
I really felt like I was watching an Eras Tour mashup again. So I guess it was a little nostalgic for the time.
I enjoyed it. I clapped. I cheered. I did. Cheered.
She sounded good.
But, you know, every so often, I think that we could... It's been a minute since the Eras Tour ended. Like, we could just let mashups go.
We could, but I'm starting to get scared that it's become something that is, like, now just a part of the experience of Swiftieism. And we like all just Easter have eggs. To... we all just have to live with it now. Okay.
Well, I think we really could have gotten Tim McGraw in there. I don't understand. You spent a lot of time talking about it.
Yeah, that's about memory, too. That's about memory, too. I hope you think of me. Hello. I knew it. I knew you. Oh, wow.
She just loves folklore so much. She always just wants to do folklore.
And I think August was also deliberately chosen because she must have known. I think it was filmed a couple weeks ago. So in August. So I think she was like, well, it's Lover.
Tis the damn season.
So you have to listen to this. Whatever. All Too Well was really the one where I was like, heard it. You could have done, I mean, I'm just throwing this out there in the ring. We could have forced a showgirl song in there. We could have.
Oh, I'm really glad that we didn't, though. We could have ruined the friendship. Actually, we really could have ruined the friendship.
That one's about memory, too.
I mean, should have kissed you anyway.
It being about memory is that's like pretty much every song. If you think about it.
Well, every song is a memory in the whole world. Every song is a memory. Not even just in Taylor Swift. Yeah. Have you ever seen a pretty girl get ugly like this? That's a memory.
That's a memory. That's a memory. That's a memory. Mm-hmm. So I thought she sounded good in the performance. It's another one of those mashups that makes you go, okay, thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, like I watched it once and I enjoyed it, but I won't be replaying very much.
No, and in comparison to other performances that she's done for, like, Grammys interviews like this, when we're talking Out of the Woods on piano, we're talking Wildest Dreams on the electric guitar, incomparable. Thank you so much.
Incomparable. And why they won't release the performance that she did if All You Had to Do Was Stay from that session, I don't know, but I will find you, and there will be consequences.
The fact that it's just sitting on, like, a USB drive somewhere is crazy.
Why? It must be
bad. Let it out. Release the tape. It must be bad.
It must be bad. If they're not, they let How You Get the Girl Out. It's kind of hard to find now, but it exists.
It was real. No, it was rare.
And it was good.
And it was good. Well, actually, that kind of leads me to something else. When I first saw that this was going to be a Grammys interview, I immediately assumed, and I think a lot of people assumed when the rumors that this even happened started a couple of weeks ago, that she was doing For Your Consideration showgirl Grammy stuff. She's not really doing that, like, at all.
Someone tried to tell us in our Patreon comments that you're not allowed, when you're doing FYCs, you're not allowed to promote your own album, which feels nonsensical to me because the purpose of an FYC is to promote the album that you want people to nominate. So I don't really buy that. That seems like a weird showgirl defender thing. But I mean, if there are any Grammy experts in the comments, of which there always seem to be some, please correct us and let us know. But no mention of showgirl whatsoever was shocking to me because I too also was really expecting this to be Showgirl is the greatest album ever made, and I would like you to consider it for album of the year, but somehow I think she knows that's not going to happen. But she's hoping.
She can join the club, if that's the case.
Hey, let's talk about something a lot of us deal with, thinning hair or hair loss. If that sounds familiar, Caps has solutions. Their hair restoration treatments are personalized, designed to strengthen your existing hair, encourage regrowth, and improve scalp health. The providers at CAPS guide you every step of the way with advanced treatments for noticeable, long-lasting results. And when you book your first hair restoration appointment, you'll get a $50 CAPS MedSpa gift card. Book today at experiencecaps.com. CAPS, where confidence begins.
She can join the club.
Well, you know what I noticed? One of the first things that was mentioned is the Bluebird Cafe. I've been there. Have you been there?
I have been there. And I think we created more of a ruckus when we went to the Bluebirds than Taylor did.
No, it's true. Did Taylor get in the Washington Post when she went to the Bluebird Cafe? No, she just got found by a random old man, Scott Borchetta. What did we do? Washington Post.
We were in the Washington Post for some bullshit, too.
Oh my gosh. Someone commented and was like, stop bringing it up. Don't remind people of that. I'm like, it's funny.
It's funny. And it was completely accidental. It wasn't like, no, I like, feel like no it was clue. Framed as they were trying, they were doing. All we were doing was having a key. It was in a tour vlog, for fuck's sake.
Like 40 minutes
in. News. But, and we were getting our photo shoot.
We were like, this is our moment. Little did we know.
It was. So, yes, every time the Bluebird Cafe is mentioned, I do think of Zach and I's sabbatical to the Bluebird Cafe. And I kind of, at first, I remember when it first happened, I was, like, kind of embarrassed. And now as time has gone on, I'm like, no, it's funny. It's literally so funny.
And everyone's crazy. Yeah,
and everyone else is crazy. It's not us. Wrong. All we did, and immediately after that, we went and ate pancakes. How serious do you think we were?
The idea that it was, like, some agenda that we had set up, like, so too, it's too funny. We were in the middle of Bus Club and Other Club.
We forgot about it.
No, completely forgot. I don't even edit the videos, so I forgot that it was even in there.
So Taylor said Bluebird Cafe, and I said, thank you so much.
Let's talk about Tim McGraw. Tim McGraw, I love the fact that this is where the interview started, and that's where I knew that a hand heart had logged into the chat. That's when I knew that someone who always spoke now and was red in their 1989 fearless gown had stepped in and said, I would like to take control of the conversation. So he asks her, he says, Tim McGraw has been very advanced. It was a very advanced writing for a young girl, so true. And asks her, like, how she got this instinct for storytelling. And she says that's what felt important to her. She said, I never turned to music to forget my human experience. I turned to music to remember it. I thought that was so interesting because a lot of people view music as escapism. And I just don't think that Taylor views it that way. She views it as, like, it can be escapist, but I think she views it as her entire project is, this is my version of events. This is Taylor's version of the story, and it matters because it's my story and I'm telling it how I want to tell it. And I just thought that was such an interesting, like, kind of dramatic thing to say right at the top of the interview.
It's one of those things that I think she came into the interview knowing in the back of her mind, I will say this. I will say this. And I always wonder, it's like, is this something that you felt like people have misconstrued about you? that you are escaping into your songs, and like it's a coping mechanism almost, or like I'm getting the heck out of here sort of a vibe. But I think with Taylor, it's like it's more I'm immersing myself into it. I'm the most excruciating pain you can imagine. I am experiencing it and I'm feeling it to the full spectrum that is possible for me to feel, because I know that I'm getting something out of it, more or less.
I also love the way she characterizes her early journey of songwriting as being a time where she was drawn to consequences and stakes and seeing decisions through. And we've talked about this a lot from debut, this period she's talking about, up until about Red. She was obsessed with like narrative conclusion, with having an answer or a story coming to an end. Like all of her songs could be entire stories in one like moment instead of being chapters in a larger story.
Yeah.
And as you get older, your life gets more complicated and you realize that like personal narratives don't resolve like that. But that is something that I loved so much about her early songwriting, was like her conviction and her ability to just make everything seem like such a contained statement. Like Teardrops on My Guitar, contained statement. Tim McGraw, contained statement.
Yeah, I think so too. I think especially songs like, you know, Mary's Song and Tied Together with a Smile, that are kind of like about other people and Stay Beautiful, like you kind of feel like in those early songs, even on debut, like she was really transporting you somewhere else, and she was introducing you to like this person who wasn't her, but was like somebody that was either in her life or that she completely made up, which is really interesting for like a 15-year-old girl at the time when she was writing these songs to be doing, especially because some of those songs were self-written. Nobody was there in the room going, you know, do this, do that. She was writing them herself.
All because she loved storytelling. She just really wanted to tell the human experience through whoever's eyes. And it's so really, it's so funny that people were so surprised by Folklore, because all of that is on debut.
Yeah, actually. It's funny because when Folklore came out, there was something that my sister said to me, actually, after she listened to it. She said, well, we always knew that she could do it. That's what she said. I think it's kind of like, yes, she had been making songs like that her whole career, but what she had never done is made an entire album of nothing but those, like, you know, glimpses that we saw on other records. Oh, that was interesting for like an outsider's perspective. Like, oh, I always knew she could do that. It's like, well, open the case.
Then she starts to cook. She starts talking about detail. And okay, a lot of people are interpreting this as shade to one person or another. I don't think that, like, I made a joke being like, it's funny that you say this when Gracie Abrams is like your number one, this is my heir apparent. It's interesting that you make this specific critique. But she starts it here. She goes on later. But here she's saying, that Tim McGraw established a pattern of detail, and that something that people bring up to her a lot about her work is that she writes in detail, and she says it's important to determine that the details have to have a significance to the story at hand. That also reminded me of like the Lucy Dacus school of songwriting, which is like, I went to the corner store and I looked at a chocolate bar and the chocolate bar had red lettering on. Like, too much is not always necessary. It has to have a significance to the story.
It's really interesting sometimes to hear her talking about songwriting to this extent, because like she has so many, like she's like friends with Lucy Dacus, and like she, you know, she's friends with Gracie Abrams. So it's like, when you engage with their work, are you thinking these things secretly?
She must be. She simply must be. But also, you know what it is? When you're a talented person, like, you give less talented people grace, right? Like, you understand that what you have is different to other people, I'm sure. So she's like, I get that you can't cook in my kitchen. So you can watch from outside, but I'm going to keep serving my delicious meals. I'm not going to pretend, however, that the sweet green that's being served next to my fine dining Michelin star restaurant is the same thing. I appreciate it, but it's not the same.
She's Mother Teresa. People have been saying this for a long time. She's Mother
Teresa.
Why have
you never said that before? Mother
Teresa. Mother Teresa.
So true.
She is Mother Teresa to everybody around her. I also think it's really hard to critique your friend's work.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Really, really hard to do that. So maybe she's just like, I loved it.
When I start peer reviewing all of your YouTube videos, yeah. I give you like notes.
Oh my God. I'm going to start doing that for Swiftologists. Like, oh, here's my notes.
I think the transition here could have been smoother.
That would be crazy.
Then she explains the line in Tim McGraw. And to be honest, I had never thought about it like this. So I was I was really glad to hear her explain it. She says the line, just a boy in a Chevy truck that has a tendency of getting stuck on back roads at night. If you look at that at face value, you're like, oh, the truck broke down. But if you look into it, the double meaning is that these are two teenagers who used to like to park and kiss and tell their parents that the truck broke down. I didn't think of it as that elaborate. I just thought of it more as like, this is a waste of time, boy.
Oh, is that how you thought of the line?
I was like, he's just kind of like a flop. And like, his is that how you thought down. Of it? Yeah, I never thought of it as like they were sneaking to make out.
That is so funny that that's how you interpreted that. I think I remember people talking about that interpretation of it, like it being, oh, so they could kiss, like on Tumblr. I remember that being something that people were talking about. I always kind of framed it as like it's a detail where it's like at the time it was so annoying, but looking back, I really miss that truck. I loved that truck, even though it always broke down. Like, that's how I always thought of it. It's one of those really great lines that's, like, up to interpretation. She meant, oh, we're secretly kissing, but it's, like, it almost doesn't even matter because everybody else has their own sort of reading on it, depending on how they're engaging with the song. I think it's so funny. You're like, he's a flop.
But it doesn't destabilize anyone's understanding of what the song means, which is why it's a good detail. It's like vague enough. This is what's really good about Taylor's songwriting. When she writes her details, they are vague enough to be generally applicable and interpretable to a lot of different people, but they're also specific enough to not lose a meaning.
Yes, exactly. And that's why she's the diva and everybody else wishes. Mother Teresa.
It really sends me, like, people in the TikTok comments are always trying to come for Taylor's songwriting. It's like whenever I make a comment about someone else's writing, they'll bring up like a lyric from Wishlist, and I'm like, you're ignoring 450 million other songs that are not Wishlist. It's like not even worth defending at this point. It's like, seriously, do your homework. People that hate her even agree that the songwriting clears.
You're allowed to make wish lists when you've made Tim McGraw, which is really saying something. Which is really saying something.
Because I wouldn't accept it from anyone else.
No, I wouldn't. I'd be like, anyway.
Anyway, thank you. And then she starts to talk about how country radio was a difficult place for her to be and how she had to do a lot of convincing to people. People fought about demographics and they were very insistent to her that, you know, she had to make music for a 35-year-old woman, and how is a 35-year-old woman going to find anything to relate to in any of her stories? And she said that these people were so obsessed with analytics and data, and they had this understanding of the market. And I found that to be such a great detail to include, because a lot of the time with music, you can get as nitty-gritty as you want about the details and the metrics, but there's a human element to it that you cannot predict and you can't model. Taylor Swift is an extremely, even our song, even as, for example, like, that's clearly about a high school relationship. She wrote it, performed it at her talent show when she was in like 9th or 10th grade. That song is so, a 35-year-old woman would hear that and go, oh my God, I remember how that felt. Or I've just fallen in love with someone else and I'm feeling that all over again right now. It's crazy to me that people weren't listening to the music just for the music and going, oh, these are great stories.
And you know what else is really interesting about like them being obsessed with demographics is that Taylor turned a lot of these bitches country. There were a lot of girls out there like me. I came from a family who, if a country song would come on the radio, I specifically remember doing this to You'll Think of Me by Keith Urban. We would make fun of it profusely. Like, it was, we would make fun of the accent, we would make fun of everything about it. This was not a country loving family, I'll say that much. And yet, why did Taylor Swift have me in cowboy boots? Why did Taylor Swift have me streaming Miranda Lambert? Like, Taylor totally changed my perception of what country music was or could be. So I kind of think, like, when you're really, really good and you're the best at what you're doing, it doesn't matter if you're 16 and you're making music for 16-year-olds or you're 50 and you're making music for 50-year-olds. It's kind of universal. It's universal to say, you know, asking God if he could play it again. How is that not universal?
She also created a market share. I think the people who were telling her no were not using their imaginations to see, okay, but what if she makes a demographic? Like, what if she creates an audience for what she's making, which she definitely did. And it's crazy that country music, like you're saying, it got you in America and you were like not a willing participant in it, basically. But it got me in Singapore. Like, I had never even heard country music pretty much at all before Taylor Swift. She really, like, she globalized country pop in a way that no other artist has been able to do before her, for a young demographic specifically. And I'm saying this, she Tay gospeled all over the world. She was a missionary. They should thank her.
And again, she Tay gospeled. She was a missionary. She did many things for many people. For me.
She performed miracles.
For the world. Mother Teresa.
Mother Teresa. We need to make her a saint.
We do. She's
performed so many miracles. I could think of 10.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the showgirl sales alone.
Gracie Abrams having a career. I can't stop.
Water into wine.
I'm stopping. So yeah, they asked her about how she managed to get over that, like get through people telling her that she couldn't. And she said, instincts. It's trusting her instincts and understanding that she's making music for the fans. She's putting out music for people who care about it and who look to music as a way to cope with their life in the way that I did. I think if you actually go through all those checkpoints and realize that putting out music you've made that you love so much is not the path to universal validation, if you're still doing it after that, then you love it for the right reasons. I think people are really interpreting this as showgirl defense, and I did not get that at all from what she was saying.
No, I think, here's what I'll say. People have showgirl on the mind. Showgirl is at the front and center. You're always thinking she's talking about what she most recently released. I don't feel the presence of showgirl really in this interview very much at all.
She is asked about why her creativity isn't blocked by this. And she says, I don't know, sometimes it fuels it. When people are mocking me, it's fun to mock them back. To me, that's 1989. That's what she's talking about there. She's talking about blank space. She's talking about, look what you made me do. She's not talking about showgirl. Sometimes I like to just use words that they have to look up in order to talk shit about. But I go through several processes and coping mechanisms that I've gone through over the years. And one of them is saying, you chose this. You chose this every day. You could have opted out of this any day before it got unmanageably big. And I decided not to because I love it that much. And that's where it begins and where it ends. Everything that comes with it is ultimately worth it as long as I get to make music. And that really reminds me of all those interviews we've been going through where whenever anyone asks her about, like, are you uncomfortable with not being able to go outside? Is it hard for you that, like, you can't, like, go for a walk in the park without it being an event?
Right.
And she goes, she always says, and this is, I think, the perspective that keeps her sane, I chose it. This isn't something that's happening to me. I made this happen.
Yeah, I think when you get to that point where it really is affecting your life in such a big way and it's never going to be the same again, you know, you can never go back, you really have to look at it as like, this is a conscious decision that I made and I'm happy that I made it. I get to do exactly what I always said I wanted to do, and I always knew there were going to be strings attached. And maybe I couldn't have foreseen all of these strings, but I am still here and I'm still making music. And it's 20 years of my career. And not everybody can say that. Not everybody has had a 20-year successful career.
Check that. Check that, boo.
Check that, boo.
Who gonna check me, boo? Me on you. So then she's asked about how she pushed herself out of her comfort zone as a songwriter, and specifically about that transition from Red into 1989. And I thought that this passage entirely was one of the most interesting parts of the interview, because she says a lot of stuff that she hasn't really said before. And she calls herself someone that doesn't want to make lateral creative moves. And I think overall, that's a fair assessment of how her albums have progressed and developed over the year. But I also thought, we've discussed a couple times about how albums 1 through 6 feel like such total innovations in and of each other. Like, after that, it doesn't get repetitive, but it becomes like evolutions of the same thing. 1 through 6, like, are completely each separate, different statements. And she says, my life was changing so quickly. And if you continue to write about your life and write from these new challenges and adventures, the sonic landscape of that will change with you. And I was thinking, it's like, she was that period of your time, like when you're growing up from 16 to 30, to 25 even, you will never go through that much upheaval as a person again. Like, that's really when you become a human being. Everything else is like building off of who you already are. And so it kind of makes sense to me that her most like diverse, polarizing, like, real statements are going to come from that period of time. You almost can't compare what comes after it to that.
Hey, let's talk about something a lot of us deal with: thinning hair or hair loss. If that sounds familiar, CAPS has solutions. Their hair restoration treatments are personalized, designed to strengthen your existing hair, encourage regrowth, and improve scalp health. The providers at CAPS guide you every step of the way with advanced treatments for noticeable, long-lasting results. And when you book your first hair restoration appointment, you'll get a $50 CAPS MedSpa gift card. Book today at experiencecaps.com. CAPS, where confidence begins.
No, especially when you're talking about, like, innovation. And it's like, well, you know, people to this day still begging for the quote-unquote rock album. Already happened. You missed it. You weren't
listen
there.
Listen to it. It's called Speak Now.
And it's like, we're never going to get another album like Speak Now again. We're never going to get another record like Reputation. We're never going to get another record exactly like 1989, in spite of, you know, her best efforts, I guess I would say. It's just like, it was lightning in a bottle, and you were at this perfect place creatively to create that exact thing. And we're never going to be able to and you shouldn't have to, by the way, shouldn't have to be expected to completely reinvent. It's kind of like, well, we have already reinvented the wheel 6 times. Not just anybody could say that either. So it's like, I'm cool. If the next album is kind of like, oh, this kind of reminds me of like the Midnight's vibe, or this is kind of like Torture Poets, or this is kind of like, I was going to say this is kind of like Showgirl. Maybe so. Who knows? I'm cool with that. I don't expect her to come out swinging with something insane. I don't. No, and I'm happy with that. And I'm happy with that.
I loved, again, she did not let Speak Now take another L in this interview. Speak Now got its flowers, and it was basically listed by her as the catalyst for her understanding not just how to write songs, but how to produce them, first of all, in the way that she likes to do it, which is building the sound from scratch, but also it helped her understand how to write to track as well. Like, it was a real catalyst for her. And I always forget she was a co-producer on Speak Now. Like, her and Nathan Chapman did the production together. She has a production credit all over that record. And when you see the behind the scenes footage of the Speak Now album creation, like, she was in that studio doing the strings, like conducting the orchestra, like she was there. And it's that classic writerly tradition, which is like, if you want to play with form in writing, you have to learn the different forms, how they are done normally first. You need to be an expert before you can start playing with the formula. And that's kind of what this is giving. Like, I learned how to do it all by myself or build something from the ground up. Now I can take moves where someone sends me a track and I write to it instead of building everything from scratch, which seems harder to me.
Writing to track seems harder.
No, building from scratch.
Building from scratch seems harder. Yeah,
writing to track is a different skill, but I think it's quicker.
I think also, like, writing to track gives you the thought. You know what I mean? Like, when she heard the invisible string, when Aaron Dessner sent her invisible string before it was invisible string, it gave her the idea of like, oh, this sounds like, it's like strings plucking. It kind of reminds me of like a long
it's a prompt.
String. It's like a prompt. As opposed to, I have to create this. I have to world build, essentially. I have to write the novel. I have to create the
Enchanted.
Whole thing. Right.
Is a great example of that. And like that production, when you really think about the production on that song, it's fucking crazy. It's really crazy for a 5-minute song. And it would be nothing without that product. Well, I mean, it's still a beautiful song, but like the production, making it sound the way that she wanted it to feel is what is so brilliant about it.
And you know, this is why Speak Now slept on. This is why Speak Now misunderstood. Because I think people didn't get it.
Get up
I think people
speak
still
down.
Don't get it today. I think Taylor doesn't get it, if I'm being totally honest with you.
No, nobody gets it.
Nobody
it's
gets
a secret.
It. It's a secret.
It's legit you get a secret. It.
You wouldn't understand.
We're so lucky that we got Speak Now, Taylor's version, that it wasn't a casualty of I got my master's back. Because there's an alternate scenario in which it didn't get made in time and it was the one that got cut on the chopping block, and that would mean that we would never have gotten Foolish One.
And we needed Foolish One so bad. I'm amazed to this day that it got cut. I can't believe it. It puts me in silence. A deluxe track, even? You put Superman out?
No, that's crazy.
But you left Foolish One behind? I find that very interesting. But nonetheless,
the album
could
have even been called Foolish One.
In many ways, it would have been very true. Speak Now is the Foolish One. Speak Now is
she
Foolish,
is the
one,
foolish one.
One to the T. Foolish. And that's why
she's
we
the
love
fool.
Her. She was the fool. To go from Fearless to Foolish One, there's something there. There's something there.
And then so once she felt like she was a master of that particular part of the craft, and as it pertains to her writing process, then she said with Red, she wanted to work with everybody. And again, that's very, I'm 22. Like, I'm finally feeling like comfortable and confident to walk into rooms with these like big producers and writers. I'm sure it's scary and nerve wracking. So she talks about, she just lists all the men that she worked with. Mm-hmm. Dan mm-hmm. Wilson, Max
yes.
Martin, Nathan Chapman, Jeff Basker. Yes. It's like, man after man, man.
Well, it was kind of, it's that clip in Miss Americana where it cuts to the boardroom and it's like, men.
I can't think of one female role model. Really?
I can't, forgot about that. I don't have a single female role model. Oh,
wind that in. Wind that back.
You had to reel it back. And she's still doing it to this day. I mean, I guess in her defense, for the time period, who were the really huge female producers that she was
there
refusing
weren't any.
To work with? So, sure, Dan Wilson, Max Martin, sure.
by the hell, I don't regret. I don't regret that.
I don't regret.
And then she actually kind of repeats this message when she's asked about, like, were there any rules in country that you had to break? And then she is reminded that she's a very high-level country writer and a high-level pop writer, and how does she navigate the difference between those two things? And she says that it's about the vernacular. She really thinks that, like, casual language being inserted into a song is, like, one of the most interesting revelations that has ever happened. Like, I was waiting for her to say stronger than a 90s trend. Like, I was so sure that that's what she was going to bring up here, but different shades of music. So she's saying, I'm into you. And her two examples are your Midas touch on the Chevy door, November flush and your flannel cure. Or you can say, you got that James Dean daydream look in your eyes. Some of us are saying, say the James Dean. I'm saying it. Say it.
You know, it's actually really interesting. Something I've never thought of before with her, like, addiction to, you know, putting in, you know, old-timey versus new age and, like, sort of, like, juxtaposing the two. Something that I think she probably got that from, or at least she was really inspired by, was, like, Lana Del Rey. Because on Born to Die, and maybe even on Ultraviolence a little bit as well, Lana would, like, for example, I say you the bestest. Like, that is, if Taylor could get away with saying, I say you the bestest, she would be doing it.
100%.
But she can't. You can't. You the bestest can only be on Born to Die by Lana Del Rey. That's just, like, where it belongs. But I've never thought about how Lana kind of probably influenced her to do that. Because I don't think before Born to Die, before Taylor was introduced to Lana, she ever really did it. Off the top of my head.
Like, she would insert a lot of colloquialisms, like ever on We Are Never is a good example.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
But in terms of mixing the high and the lowbrow of it all, like in Willow specifically, that was a much later evolution in her songwriting process. Also, I think this is a weird parallel that she's drawing to say that those two sentences mean the same thing. I'm kind of like, well, the whole thing about style is that you just kind of want to fuck. It's not about I'm in love with you and you're breaking my heart. It's about we're fucking each other up. Let's just keep going.
But you know what? I think it's really interesting that she had this opportunity to really champion a showgirl song, because she's saying, like, oh, I can do silly writing and I can do very serious writing, and I'm really good at both. She could have said, Redwood Tree, it ain't hard to see, your love was the key that opened my thighs.
Or Ophelia. This was the prime moment for an Ophelia lyric, actually.
Keep it 100 on the land, the sea, the sky, you know, like one of those kind of mementos. And she says instead, no, style. And she's right. For the record, like, we're talking silly songwriting. Like, if that's your measure of silly songwriting, I think you went with the higher end, is what I would say about style. Like, I wouldn't call style silly. I'd call it almost casual, or, like, it's not that serious. It's fun. It's sexy. Not...
it's irreverent.
Silly. As opposed to, like... Daisy's bare naked. I was just like, it's just kind of a different. I mean, the tea was set up for her to reference Showgirl, and she didn't do it.
It's so interesting. And then this is the part where people really were like, she's getting Swiftologist. I got a lot of this.
Really?
Fans will say, contradictions will come up, and fans will be like, I can't believe the same person who wrote this, because one will be very simplistic and silly, and the other will be, like, very detailed and deep, and we're doing tons of allegory, and we're just in a whole other atmospheric world. But I think that human contradiction is fun. It's fun to make playful songs. It's fun to make songs that are desolate and lonely and just bedraggled lyrically as well. And that's the human contradiction that I find interesting. When have I ever argued with that? The issue with Showgirl is not that it's silly, it's that it's not well written.
There's a difference. I don't understand how she's getting anybody. Like, it doesn't
they always want her to be getting someone
pointed to me. It just feels,
especially,
like,
us.
Oh, fans say. And it's like, well, I mean, I don't think she sounds mad about it, but it is also really interesting, though, how, like, people have this perception of, like, if you don't like Showgirl, it is because you don't like fun. And I find that really interesting, because it's been like, I've been doing this for 20 years. I've been having fun. Stay. I like Stay. People hate that song. I like it. I like Paper Rings. I like Blank Space.
You're talking to a girl at home, Defender.
I like London Boy. Like, she has so many exceptionally great, fun, even silly pop songs that I would defend with a sword in my hand. London Boy probably.
We Are Never.
Great song. We Are Never. I Knew Your Trouble in some ways is kind of goofy. But it's like,
Shake It Off is goofy.
I'm over here clapping and cheering, because at the end of the day, what she's saying is, it doesn't matter if it's silly or if it's serious, or if I'm, you know, being tongue in cheek, or if I'm being very direct. If it's good and I'm proud of it, And it's like,
and I'm still thinking about it. It never comes from a place of faultlessness.
Daisy's bare naked. I was distraught. He loves me not.
And then you get material like that, and it's hard to reconcile.
Well, you can't look. Even like Reputation. Reputation is a great example because she was saying things that were kind of, I guess you could argue, in the vein of some stuff that she says on Showgirl, like in the sense that she's kind of being like a character and it's so over dramatic or like so exaggerated that it's ridiculous. Like, for this is why we can't have nice things. That's one that's like, there's something Showgirl about that song. But first of all, she came onto that shit mad as hell. Open the case.
She's genuinely enraged.
She, I mean, it's literally, it interpolates Hard Knock Life, or actually it interpolates Annie. So it's like, that's unserious. Why do I like that song if I'm such a hater of fun? See, now this is devolving into Leave
No, we can get it back on track. We're going to get it back on track. Leave Madeline alone. Then she's talking about like writing sessions and her writing process. And she's asked, like, how do ideas come to you? And like, do you have any preference for that order? And also, like, you like alliteration. And I think actually her answer here is so good. She's like, I'm sitting here talking about the craft and like what I like and what I think. But when I do it, I'm in a flow state and I'm being instinctual. I'm following my instincts and I'm executing. And that is not really a conscious state. Like, you're doing it, but you're not thinking of like what it's going to be. And I think there are so many moments in her catalog where you can point to where she's leaning into that more versus not, like when she's really over executing and overthinking. For example, when you're in the middle of writing Me and you're not even done writing it and you say, this is the lead single. That's the opposite example of what she's talking about here. Not in a flow state, over calculating, over producing. But she also reaffirms that she can't put something down for a minute if it's not finished. It needs to be finished, start to stop. She can't just walk away from something and pull things out later, like pull different verses from places. A lot of artists do that. Beyonce is actually a huge fan of cobbling together songs in that way. Taylor says that she just can't. And she also, what else does she say? Yeah, she's also not judgmental about how ideas come to her. She'll take them in whatever form they arrive.
And I'm cheering. I feel like this is probably some of the most extensive conversation she's ever had about songwriting. Although she did say, did you hear at one point, she said, it happens differently every time. I was like,
it was like,
I was taken right back to the 1989 voice notes. It happens differently every time. I was like, yes! I haven't heard her say such a thing in so long. It's really interesting. Like, I feel like for the first time in a very long time, I'm getting like a peek into actually how these things come about and like her mind and her state of being like as she comes into the studio or when she just writes.
It's interesting as well. I think I wonder if the audience of it being other industry people, other songwriters, like did that make her more focused on the craft of it all? Because with the New York Times, it was very much like explaining why I am one of the greatest songwriters versus here being like, let's get into the weeds with my peers, my like-minded people. Like, let's talk about how these things have actually come to be. She goes on to tell a story about how Max Martin and Johann Schellback shocked her by saying that her sad piano ballad called I Knew Your Trouble needed to be a dubstep song. I would love to have been in the room when that transpired just to see her face.
I'm sure, especially at the time, because like in 2012, dubstep was like the thing. It was like the hip, trendy thing. And
it was
so
shocking when we learned there was a dubstep song, because we knew it before we heard it. It had been mentioned and we were like, oh.
I kind of remember thinking like I thought it was really trendy. And up to that point, she had never really been trendy before. I was like, huh. I remember thinking it was sort of hopping on to a train that was already moving. Does that make sense?
It was.
And it was, and it works. I mean, I was wrong, but I remember when it first came out, there was going to be dubstep, and I heard the clip of it on Good Morning America back when she used to do that. I was devastated. I was like, this is the worst thing that's ever happened in the history of the world. Like, she's over. She cooked herself. And thank God I was wrong. Thank God I was wrong.
Thank God you were wrong. Thank God you were wrong. Then she is asked about the creative spirit and process with a little album called Reputation. And she specifically asked, everybody thought they knew the story. How did that change what you wrote? And how did the public's perception make you lost? First of all, she 100% got all the questions in advance and prepared her answers. That is 100% the way that this happened. And I'm not against that, because I think in a circumstance like this, like, you actually need to sit there and reflect on how you want to answer questions like this instead of just being put on the spot, because you'll give a better answer when you have more time to prepare. But she's asked about Reputation, and there is a studious no mention of it being a love story, which is so funny, because the way that she used to reference it would be like, it's like 15% vindictive and like 85% love story. And it's the secret love story that people didn't really understand. And like, love story is taken out of it completely. Instead, she focuses on the angle about how when you're been backed into a corner and you're being hated in a certain way, this is very good PR advice, I think, you can't respond with outward sincerity. Any attempts you make to explain yourself earnestly or sincerely will just be mocked even worse. And so it was an interesting challenge as a writer to say, what can you possibly say when everything you say is being returned to you in this distorted overreaction rather than a reaction to anything that you say or do? And so I decided to put out Look What You Made Me Do. And it's like, that saved her career.
And, you know, I listened to Look What You Made Me Do today. It just kind of came up on shuffle, and I let it play. I have it on my spooky fall playlist, so, you know, I got to let it play. And I was like, you know, this song is so much different than any other Taylor song. It has something about it, which is that it feels so much more in character and as if she's playing a part than any other Taylor song that exists, even any other song on Reputation. Like, this person does not exist. She has, like, never existed. It exists only in this context. And it's like, it was a wig, and when she puts it on for the Eras Tour and stuff like that, like, you really see the shift in her attitude and, like, her behavior. Like, the Reputation set on the Eras Tour had such an energy and a vibe to it. Even in the way that she was performing, you can tell that she loves to put that wig on. And it's so, yeah, it's not really her. Hard to do. Not just anybody can do that. Some people make their entire career about putting the wig on. Lady Gaga comes to mind. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. That's a character that I am. Lady Gaga, I'm Stephanie, and that's Lady Gaga. And she takes over on the stage. And, like, that's really cool. Taylor somehow mastered the art of being incredibly, like, diaristic and, like, this is really me. And then also, and here's me with my wig on. And it is true that some people didn't get it. Some people
it
were
is
like,
true that some people didn't get it. But it was also, I think it's more surprising that people did get it. Because technically, like, it was very alienating, and it did alienate people for sure, and that's a risk that you take when you make a creative decision like that. But also, it paid dividends, because at the end of the day, she's right. Nothing, if she had put out a song being like, I'm so misunderstood and I feel so bad and it sucks to be canceled, she would have just been mocked into oblivion. And she was mocked when Look What You Made Me Do came out, but people were really interested to see what a defensive Taylor Swift would look like, because she had been perceived as the perpetual victim. I think leaning into the villain narrative and character was genuinely like a renegade thing for her to do. And people were, even if they hated it, deeply compelled by it.
Yes, I think it was the best thing that she could have possibly done. It was hard to see that at the time. Not that I ever disliked anything about Reputation, but you don't know what something is until you have hindsight. And looking back, it's like she could not have done anything better than what she did. And people call it one of the greatest comebacks in pop. I tend to agree. Maybe I'm biased, but like,
no, it's saved her career. There was an alternate universe where, like, she really was no longer the top artist anymore after that. It was that serious. So congratulations, Tay Mother Teresa. You really did that. You did that. Then she's asked about visuals. I thought this was so funny. So this is the question about Reputation and Lover, Darkness and Light. Are you intentional about the visuals? And she was like, you know, I'm not a big mood board artist. I start with my mood as like how I feel, and then that's how my life happens. And the aesthetics are the last thing that I decide. Some little details come to me along the way, but those things happen later. And I was like, girl, we know that you don't think about the album visuals until the 11th hour. We know that.
I think it's also really telling, like, the fact that you don't really think about visuals very much is like, well, yeah. So it's really interesting to me that you want to direct everything then.
Hey, let's talk about something a lot of us deal with, thinning hair or hair loss. If that sounds familiar, Caps has solutions. Their hair restoration treatments are personalized, designed to strengthen your existing hair, encourage regrowth, and improve scalp health. The providers at CAPS guide you every step of the way with advanced treatments for noticeable, long-lasting results. And when you book your first hair restoration appointment, you'll get a $50 CAPS MedSpa gift card. Book today at experiencecaps.com. CAPS, where confidence begins.
Oh, clock that tea. Really,
because
clock
it's like,
that tea.
It's, I don't think there's anything wrong with, like, I feel like she's basically admitting, like, I write songs, I don't really, you know, the aesthetics are kind of like secondary.
Yeah, and story first.
I would think
and story
that.
Is words. For exactly. Her, story is words. For some people, story is visual. Right. For her, she makes it clear that it's words.
So it's really interesting to me, this crusade that she's been on to direct and to be so in control of the visuals and to not let essentially somebody else's vision come into play where it's like, well, there are people who could really, and you know this because you did this for years, you worked with people who did this for you for years, that could really make the idea that you have in your head and the story that you're telling come to life in a deeply compelling way. And it's interesting to me to hear her pretty much admit aesthetics are, you know, secondary to me, and then like still be insisting I'm directing everything. Remember when there was the My Direction stuff on her website? There was like a tab dedicated to directorial projects. Oh my god, I forgot about that.
When she was trying to get her Oscar.
Where did that go?
Let's see it again, shall we? Let's have another look.
Yeah.
But also that's why I think having another pair of eyes on it is good, because like maybe you need to take the thing that you thought of conceptually first and give it to someone else and let them use their visual oriented brain on it. That's why her directed music videos that are not directed by her end up being more interesting. Not necessarily better, but more interesting.
This is another clue, I think, that like, I don't know if this movie is happening, girls.
The movie's dead.
I wonder if we could pack it up.
I thought that it was interesting that her example of like fans really relating to something that she wrote in isolation, the first songs out of her mouth, Peace and Hoax. What?
That's really relatable? Interesting that she said that. I mean, and so in the sense that I hope, you know what, for the sake of everybody listening, I hope that you don't relate to Hoax that much, because that's dark. That's incredibly dark stuff. So I hope that in quarantine, during the pandemic, you were relating to an Invisible String moment, or, you know, even a fucking August moment, a Cardigan. Well, you know.
The One is even less dark than Hoax.
And I think a lot of people were thinking on what could have been during that time. Because when you're just like stuck in the house for a long time, it's a lot of time to think. Some would say too much.
Too much time. Then she talks about like Toy Story and folklore a little bit more. But then we get into the cookage. She's asked about being a confessional songwriter. So she's asked, what does it mean to you? And she says, I think that when I say the term confessional songwriter, I think it's important to specify that not all shocking revelations you make about yourself are deep. Just saying something dramatic and shocking and wild doesn't make it something that's going to help people or resonate with people. It won't make it a story that sits in people's minds, hearts, and souls. We have to be purposeful. We can't just scream something crazy and be like, I'm a confessional songwriter, just for the exact same reason why details should not be strictly decorative. Let's not be haphazard with these things. Let's make them count. There's a song on my album, Fearless, which is the second album I put out, girl, we know, and it's all written from the perspective of a child singing about their mother, but you never hear the word mom or mother or mommy or anything, because the narrator is saying, it's getting cold, I've got my big coat on, and those details serve the purpose of telling us exactly who our narrator is. That was a great example of the importance of detail and context, and I feel like she really cooked pulling that up. That was a random pull that she roped in to make that point.
Yeah, some of her pulls are deeper than even I could do.
And I love it.
I somehow think I've listened to a lot of her songs more than she has. I would think that. but so she has a extremely good eye for a great catch. I think it was really, really interesting that people en masse immediately took the you're not a confessional songwriter if you just scream something crazy to be Charlie Shade. It's like,
I don't get that. Think when that's has she ever fair. Identified as a confessional songwriter?
She never
either.
Has.
Like, that's not a label that Charlie has owned or anybody has applied to her. And also what she's saying here doesn't really apply to Charlie.
No, I don't think Charlie's even a thought in her head during this. It's interesting to me that this is kind of what happens when you open the box, you open Pandora's box, and you let the rivalry and the, oh, Charlie versus Taylor Stan War starts. I'm not blaming her in any way, shape, or form. It's her right to respond to anything the way that she wants to. But this is just like a natural conclusion to doing that. It's like, now it's always, I'm getting Charlie. I don't think Taylor's thinking about Charlie even for a moment during this interview, believe it or not. I just don't think that has anything to do with Charlie at all.
They also create so differently. The way that they make music could not be more opposite, and that is a good thing for both of them. So that was kind of a stupid thing to include.
I'm opposite. I'm on the other side. Many people are saying
that. But it is interesting to me that we're saying Somber Bit, greatest songwriter ever made, and Gracie Abrams, ever songwriter ever made, and holding these beliefs. It makes me SMH at her, because I'm like, Taylor, so you're lying then. You know that the tea doesn't clock. You know it. And yet you're pretending that it does. Why? To what end?
When the finna is tea, then chow is gag.
So it's true.
It's true. Thank you so much, Ethel.
Ethel Cain hated this Instagram post. Mm-hmm. She did.
Thank you.
And she makes some jokes about
not being vocal about the Taylor's Version project. Yeah, and she, again, I'm always here to hear her hammering down about how important and crazy that this, like, reclamation of her own work was. And this is where she kind of gets into the my greatest hits of stories I've already told. So, like, All Too Well at the Grammys, we've heard this. Cruel Summer becoming a single, we've heard this before. And that's amazing. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I loved it. Sometimes an anecdote I've heard a million times, it washes over me like a blanket.
Mm-hmm. No, it's, you know? When I hear sonically cohesive, I snuggle up.
Oh, thank you so much.
Oh, I heard that before. Say that again.
I'm safe.
Then when she's talking about, like, craft and giving people specific advice, she makes a really good note, which is that if you ever have an idea, you have to commit it to memory. If you think that you're going to remember it, you're not. And it doesn't matter what you're doing. You need to stop what you're doing and write it down and then return to it with fresh eyes and try and make something out of it. Taylor's all about follow through. And that's where a lot of creatives get lost, I think, is, like, your great ideas go nowhere if you don't try and execute them. Like, if you're not brave enough to just speak now.
It's very true. And I think Taylor is definitely, well, we know she speaks now. She's fearless. She speaks now in her red dress in 1989 at midnight.
She to save her reputation.
Exactly. So I think Taylor, in my mind, thinking about these people, you know, these other songwriters and composers sitting there, you know, listening to her and, like, getting these pearls of wisdom. When I was watching it, I was like, you know, there probably really is nobody better that if I was a songwriter, then I would want to give me advice. Like, this is the one. It doesn't matter what you think about her. Obviously, something she does works. So it's like, this is the person that you want to hear from. And I think she gave great advice to a lot of the people in the room. I was, like, imagining them as being, like, young people. That's like, she's like the, you know, the TED Talk speaker at a college or something. But probably many of them were very established composers and songwriters. But I just like to think, like, oh, this is the next generation of, you know, great pop songwriters or something like that. I was writing fan fiction.
Oh, 100%. Those are the people that I want to hear from. I think, and then also at the end, she said something very, very interesting. Two things that were interesting. One, don't ever be the no person in a room. And she actually got specific about this because she was cut off earlier in the interview. She says, don't be the no person without a better idea. And that's when the finna is tea, but the chal is gag. That exactly. Is what we really need to be talking about. Because Taylor needs to hear no, for sure. We know that. But I take her point that it has to be a no and or no but, like, with a replacement. You don't want to be the person that walks into the room and shuts everyone's idea down for the sake of it without having a better idea. That's not good collaboration. So that's actually great advice for anybody that has to collaborate ever.
It's great advice for Meryl Streep's Miranda Priestley. Florals for Spring, groundbreaking. Well, what's your idea, Miranda?
Yeah, Miranda,
give us
you come
your
up with something.
Genius thought. So I think everybody always hates that person in the room that's, you know, when you had to do a group project or something and they just go, no, that's stupid. Okay, well, what's your genius fucking idea then? Since
yeah,
you're the,
why don't
the
you
ringleader.
Come up with something else?
She's so right. No, she's so right. And it makes me wonder, who has she encountered?
Who said no?
Who says no and doesn't offer any other ideas? Who was it? I want names. Put him in front
well,
of me.
Max says no, but Max gives ideas, so it's not him. I would like to see. We need to comb through people she's only worked with once or twice and see what the real tea is with that. And then also she ends it with, I think, the most revealing thing of this entire interview, and it felt very pointed and very deliberate. I love my country roots more and more the further along this path I get, and I want to honor them more and more, and I feel more tied and more loyal to them. The people that shaped who I am as an artist and a writer, that all happened in Nashville. She said, Ella Langley, hold my purse.
She said, Ella Langley, hold my fucking purse. Because I'm coming. I'm knocking you
down.
She
said, the HBIC is about to clock back in. Oh, you bitches want country music? Oh, you want chart monsters? I'll be right back. Give me 10 minutes and I'll cook something up.
Ella Langley, I know that you've been enjoying your time in the sun, but you are about to, a cloud is about to come and you are about to go hungry. Your crops will not grow.
This is not America's next top best friend. This is America's next top model. And you're
diva is coming to diva out on everybody, and it's going to make everybody else look like child's play. Just watch this space. She's taking over the charts with I Knew It, I Knew You, which again is a great song. But come on. You know what I mean?
Like, it's time. It's and time. You know what? It's so interesting. Critics have been gagging for her country return since she left it in 1989. Everybody's been like, when's she coming back? When's she coming back? Nashville has always said, we have an open door policy to her. Whenever she wants to come back, she can. And finally, the commercial reality makes sense. Do you see how all the stars are aligning? Ooh, it's profitable and successful to be doing country music again. I'm Taylor Swift, who's really good at doing country music. Wow. That's interesting.
And I must say, I wouldn't mind a Jack song or two. I wouldn't mind an Aaron song or two, but I would really like to see her work with some producers from back in the day.
Nathan Chapman, let's get him in there. Liz Rose.
Yeah, like all those old collaborators that she used to have. I just think it would be really interesting. And maybe some of the new, I don't know anything about who's producing.
Jack can do country. I'm going to give that to him. Jack can do country. He did the Chicks album that was really good, but
there's Jack Country. I feel like, I mean, I don't love what he did on I Knew It, I Knew You.
It's his interpretation of what country is, which is a very Jack Antonoff thing.
I think there's a difference between I'm Jack Antonoff and I am kind of going with the grain and I'm sort of figuring out what country is. And I grew up listening to country music. I am from Tennessee. I lived in Nashville. Like, you know what I mean? Like, he can be there. But I'm like, I don't know who the big new country producers are. I have no fucking idea. Couldn't tell you
well,
in years.
They're talentless. I'll tell you that for free. They're talentless. I'm not interested in their behavior. But this, if we're talking about rehabbing our image post-Showgirl and just post in general controversy, the number one thing she could do that would endear her to the public and would give her another folklore kind of renaissance would be to return to country music.
Well, no? it's kind of like one of those cards. You know, an artist as prolific as she is, who's been doing this for 20 years, a lot of, you know, the shock everyone cards, like, she doesn't have a lot left. One of them is, I'm country again. And it's like, I think she's kind of been waiting for when can I pull that card out of my deck? She's toyed with it a little bit, you know, a little Betty here, a little this there, a little Ruin the Friendship, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But, like, a full-blown country record, that's a card that she has yet to play. And, I mean, you know, the temperature is right in the sky for her to... Yeah.
The winds are blowing in a very country direction.
The winds are blowing.
I do have a dark vision of a flop debut TV vault track.
Okay, don't say another
dominating
word
the Hot 100.
Because last time you had a dark vision, it came true.
Oh my God, I forgot that.
No more.
No, it really did. It came true in like a really, really scary way.
And it was so specific.
No, it was actually, it was prophetic. That was terrifying.
There is something about like how well we know Taylor that like even our worst nightmares are things that she could actually do. Because we don't get
our flowers right, for the knowledge.
No, like we really know way too much. We only we could have said something like that and have it actually come true.
And it's on tape. And nobody ever wants to admit it. And even, you know what? And that wasn't even like a theory. That just came to us in the middle of the
episode. We were joking around. We were like, that's not going
to
happen.
And then we moved back to, Showgirl's going to be the greatest album ever made. Swiftie Psychosis. Well, the country record is coming and I'm here. Sweet Tea and Goggins Grace is number one for 20 weeks.
I think that's a beautiful note to leave it on. Thank you so much to country in some things. Thank you so much to Taylor. Yeah. Thank you so much to the Grammys CEO.
Mm-hmm. And nothing for Ella Langley.
And nothing for Ella Langley. Thank you so much.
Hey, let's talk about something a lot of us deal with, thinning hair or hair loss. If that sounds familiar, CAPS has solutions. Their hair restoration treatments are personalized, designed to strengthen your existing hair, encourage regrowth, and improve scalp health. The providers at CAPS guide you every step of the way with advanced treatments for noticeable, long-lasting results. And when you book your first hair restoration appointment, you'll get a $50 CAPS MedSpa gift card. Book today at experiencecaps.com. CAPS, where confidence begins.